Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Five words you probably don't expect to hear from a business school professor are stop looking for a job. Yep, that's what Diane Mulcahy tells students in her MBA classes at Babson College. Instead of applying for a conventional 9-to-5 job, she tells her students to become members of the so-called gig economy, because that, she says, is where real growth is happening. And research shows that Mulcahy may be onto something. According to a study from the Freelancers Union and Upwork, 53 million Americans, about 34% of the total workforce, are now freelancing either full-time or part-time. And while some workers are happy with the flexibility, others are frustrated by a lack of benefits and predictable incomes. Diane Mulcahy is author of The Gig Economy, The Complete Guide to Getting Better Work, Taking More Time Off, and Financing the Life You Want. She's an adjunct lecturer at Babson College, where she created and teaches the MBA class Entrepreneurship and the Gig Economy. Diane, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. Any of you students, would you consider going to work in the gig economy? Freelancers, are you happy without a conventional job? What are some of the benefits and what are some of the drawbacks? Is the gig economy a way of the future? Is it a way out of the cubicle? Or is it a way for employers to reduce labor costs? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Diane, what does gig economy really mean? Let's start with that.
That's a great place to start. And the way that I talk about the gig economy is basically anybody who is not a full-time employee in a full-time job. So if you are a contractor, a consultant, a freelancer, an on-demand worker, a part-time worker, you're in the gig economy.
But we've always had those.
We've always had those. This is not a new thing.
Right. So why are we talking about it right now? Is it more representative of our workforce? Are people more attracted to it? Why is it a bigger deal right now?
Well, there are a couple of things that are driving the growth of the gig economy. So it's definitely growing. It's moving from into traditional middle class white collar jobs, which is causing a lot of people to talk more about it. But really, it's for three reasons that it's growing. One is jobs are disappearing. The second is full-time employees are the worker of last resort for a lot of companies. And third is a lot of workers find it really attractive to join the gig economy.
What do you mean workers of last resort?
So what I mean is when companies think about putting together their workforce, full-time employees
are
expensive and they're rigid. So if you look to Silicon Valley and you look at a lot of the most high-growth, highly valued companies in our economy, their business model is one in which there's a core group of full-time employees surrounded by an ever-changing dynamic swirl of contractors, consultants, freelancers, and that really is the business model of the future. We're seeing, you know, Facebook and Twitter, they have 2,500, 5,000, 10,000 employees. We're not seeing GEs coming, developing that have 300,000 employees.
So
very different model.
I wonder, what do you think is driving this growth then? Is it more on the part of the workers or the employers? Are the employers looking at this and saying, hey, this is a way we can really reduce costs. We don't have to go to those rigid full-timers all the time. We can make it more project-based. We need to get this done. We hire people, we get it done. We're not obligated to keep them on. Or is it both of these things combining at once to create this growth?
What it's
is
both it? Of those things combining.
I Who's mean, there's the bigger driver, do you think?
I think I don't know that there is a bigger driver. I think it really is both sides of the equation. I think that there are a lot of people that are very interested in an alternative to full-time work. Every study shows that workers are disengaged, unhappy, unsatisfied, unchallenged in their full-time jobs. And companies are looking for ways to adapt quickly, to bring on new skills as they need them, and to cut costs.
Right. But what about that lack of predictability? And the lack of benefits is probably the biggest thing. Those are tied to full-time work. If you don't work full-time, you don't get health insurance, right? I mean, isn't that the traditional thinking? Is that changing?
I think that's the traditional narrative.
Right.
First of all, I think job security is gone. So there is, unless you're a full-time tenured professor, your job is not secure at any time. It can be eliminated, automated, outsourced, offshored, contracted out. So once you come to terms with that, you realize actually taking a job and putting all of your sort of labor eggs into the one company basket is actually quite risky. Mm. You're better off having more than one source of income, more than one having a broader portfolio of gigs.
You know, I want to play a little bit of tape here. We've obviously been talking about the economy, changes in the economy, folks not working the traditional 9-to-5 job for a long time, we in the public radio community. And we heard from a woman named Diane Gowder, who's a 65-year-old member of the gig economy. She spoke with KPCC in California this year, and she got laid off from her job in 2005, and she became a sales rep for an eyewear company working on commissions instead of having a salary. And she said she doesn't think she's going to have enough to retire based on that. But here is how she described the shift for her. Let's listen.
It was a huge switch. I didn't have a steady income. It was up, it was down at certain times of the year, particularly Christmas. Nobody wants to see you at Christmas. I wish I was an employee. I wish I had benefits, and I wish I didn't have to worry about it.
So, Diane, what do you say to people who are workers like Diane?
Yeah, well, as I said, I think that even if you are in a full-time job and you have a steady salary, that is not secure. It's very risky to place, you know, to really count on that and rely on that for stability, particularly over any kind of medium to long-term time frame. I think in terms of benefits, the Affordable Care Act really did change the game for that, because now if you're an independent worker, you can get health insurance on your own, which you used to have a full-time job in order to access health insurance. So I think that's been a game changer. In terms of saving for retirement, you're actually better off if you're an independent worker, because you can save so much more and so much faster for retirement than if you are an employee.
Why?
Well, because
you don't have a certain income, so you have to, you know, there's a different amount. You're not budgeting necessarily, so you've got to make enough to pay your mortgage and your bills, right? And
okay, if you have a mortgage, but you have to manage your finances differently. But the opportunity to save more and faster is available to you as an independent worker. Under the current retirement savings rules, independent workers can save up to around, depending on your situation, $50,000 a year towards retirement. Whereas if you're a full-time employee, you're capped at about $18,000, again, depending on your circumstances.
You say it's risky for folks to only think of a full-time career as safe and secure, right? A full-time job as being safe and secure. What should folks who maybe have that now think of instead that might be better for them, do you think?
Well, what I talk about in the book is moving from this idea of job security, which no longer exists, to income security. So for workers today, and what I tell my students is, rather than thinking about how can I get a job and how can I rely on a company for my financial security, which is very risky, think more about how can I develop the skills and expand my network and create opportunities so that I can always generate the income I need to support the lifestyle that I choose.
I want to remind listeners that we want to talk to you about the gig economy. Are you working in the gig economy? Do you think it's a wave of the future, or is it a way for employers to reduce labor costs? Call us with your comments at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Bobby is calling from Cambridge. Bobby, you're on the air.
Hey there. I just wanted to make a comment that this is definitely the wave of the future for people who are flexible enough to be able to do freelance work in whatever industry that they're in. Personally, I was at an IT startup about 10 years ago as a network engineer, and I got promoted to an account manager, which allowed me to do work from home. I then transitioned into a work-at-home contractor for the company I worked for, and was able to essentially brand myself as a high-level account manager in IT for that company and for freelance work as well. Mm-hmm. And it really worked out well for me today. I'm not in IT anymore, but I'm an audio engineer. I have taken the skills that I learned going through that, and now I'm an on-demand or freelance worker in the audio industry.
And I'm wondering, Bobby, do you feel nervous at all? I mean, do you feel insecure, or do you feel more in control of your financial future? What does it make you feel like? We've heard some people are nervous. They wish they had a predictable job with benefits and things you go to. Others say that, no, they like the flexibility and they feel more in control. Where are you on that?
So I was definitely nervous 10 years ago when I was just starting out because I did not have as much experience selling my brand or my skills. I definitely look at it from a brand sort of angle. I'm at the point now where I can fall back on any of the skills that I've developed over the last 10 years if one thing isn't working. You know, some months I don't have as much audio work as I do technical work and vice versa. So I'm not really at the point anymore where I'm nervous about my financial stability. I've kind of been through that fire and come out on the other end with very few issues. I mean, I own my own home. I'm extremely happy in my life. You know, I don't know what to say.
All right.
I don't have that. I don't have that. Those feelings.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, Diane Mulcahy. Do you think that Bobby's right here in terms of having to brand himself and being able to sort of build on his name to be able to create that financial stability in his own life that maybe a full-time job might have afforded him before, but now he's doing it on his own?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you tell your students that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think in the gig economy, you really are responsible for creating, you know, the brand of you, the company of you, however you want to talk about it. But you are as good as your last gig, and you have to always be thinking about what are the skills that I can be developing that are in demand in the marketplace? How can I expand my work, my network, and create future opportunities?
I'm going to take another call here. Pam is calling from Newton. Pam, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I was wondering if the speaker could address the fact that there's a common misperception among employers that if they simply call somebody a worker as opposed to an employee, they somehow can escape responsibility for paying their fair share of the taxes, the appropriate wages, commissions, etc. There's something known as a control factor test, which basically in plain terms is you look like an employee and walk like an employee and talk like an employee. Then the employer can't call you a contractor and avoid paying you. And in fact, there's, in Massachusetts anyway, it would be a violation of various laws if they avoided paying you your full wages and benefits. So I'd be curious if the speaker could address that.
Yeah, I think that's a big issue.
Yeah.
When I was researching, I have a policy chapter in the book, and when I was researching, you know, the labor market structure and the division between contractors and employees, it became very clear that there are numerous definitions for what a contractor is and what and how you think about classifying an employee. And the problem is there are many definitions, none of them are clear, and they conflict with each other. So employers are really in a tough spot. My take on this really is that we have designed a labor market structure where it essentially penalizes you if you don't have a full-time job. So full-time employees are, you know, given the maximum kind of salary, benefits, protections, rights. And if you're not a full-time employee, you immediately start to lose all of those things. And I think with the growth of the gig economy and increasing numbers of workers choosing to work in the gig economy, either on the side or as part of a full-time portfolio of gigs, we need to really think about a labor market that supports all workers, no matter when, where, how, or how much you choose to work. And I think the problem with the labor market structure today is we're stuck trying to fit this round peg of current workers into this square hole of outdated labor laws.
There's a related question here. Jessica is calling from Tewksbury. Jessica, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering, my husband was for a long time and still kind of is considered a contractor in sort of the gig economy. And what we've noticed as we're trying to buy a house is that the banks don't really like to give mortgages to people who don't have a steady full-time 9-to-5. So how would you deal with, you know, if you're telling young people that that's the better option, how do they then approach that when it comes time for them, if they would like to buy a house? How would they deal with that kind of thing?
Okay, how do they get credit and things, Diane, without an income?
Yeah, yeah. Such a good question, because as I was just talking about these outdated labor laws and labor market structure, I would say also that the financial services industry has not caught up to this at all. And if you're trying to get a mortgage and you're working in the gig economy, it can be a challenge because banks are still looking at this one model of a W-2 income. What I found when I did interviews for the book, what I found people saying was that they had more success with local community banks that that understand the local market, that get to know their customers really well, and that have a little more flexibility to create mortgages and loans and other financial solutions for people who are not in a traditional full-time job. I also discuss in the book that, you know, what the gig economy is really causing people to question is the whole idea of home ownership and how prevalent that is going to be, at least the way we know it today, as the gig economy continues to grow.
How prevalent it's going to be?
Yeah, I mean, home ownership is on the decline.
Mm-hmm.
And the gig economy could accelerate that because it's harder to take on a highly leveraged fixed cost if you have a variable income.
Right. You know, I want to bring up something that the Harvard economist Larry Katz talked about when he spoke about the gig economy. He actually spoke on our show here at WBUR On Point about this, and he said that the gig economy helps drive income inequality. We pulled a clip from that show, and I want to take a listen to it now.
About a third of the growth of inequality in the U.S. economy over the last couple decades appears to be from this fissuring of the workplace. It used to be that if you were at a big company like General Motors or Goldman Sachs or Harvard University, you shared when they were doing very well. Now, if you're an independent contractor or they can threaten to contract out, you no longer share in those benefits.
That's Harvard economist Larry Katz. Diane Mulcahy, what do you say to that? I mean, is there something to say about income inequality and how, you know, how do we restructure things to make sure that that is not what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the gig economy is not a panacea. I think in our jobs economy, we have income inequality between, you know, professionals and people in traditionally bad jobs. In the gig economy, equally, there are winners and losers. So there are people who move from traditional full-time jobs into the gig economy and work as contractors and freelancers and are much better off. They have, you know, they are able to generate much more income. They have more flexibility, more autonomy. They're more satisfied. They're more challenged. So they're really the winners in the gig economy. But equally, there are people who have gone from traditional middle-class jobs and are now in contractor roles that don't pay them as much, that don't give them as satisfying work, that they are less challenged, less interested, and in more precarious situation. Mm-hmm. So it really depends.
I want to make sure we can get some more calls in here. David is calling from Jamaica Plain. David, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. Yeah. Relevant to that last point, I'm worried that the speaker here is really just describing another form of old-fashioned exploitation and giving it a glossy new word and asking us to downgrade our expectations for the kind of income and the kind of life we're going to live. So I'm really curious. I mean, did you talk to folks who are already in stable jobs with low incomes, or is this really just speaking to high-wage earners already who now just get to, you know, work from home? It seems like nothing good for the most of us.
So you're saying this is for high wage earners who have the ability, really, and the circumstances to be able to brand themselves to make a maybe more lucrative living and more flexible living than they would otherwise, and those similar things would not be available to folks who are lower down on the income totem pole, if you will. Is that what you're saying, David?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're speaking, this is great if you're able to save $18,000 to $50,000 a year. Are you kidding me? I mean, for most of us, that's just so out of the range of possibility. So to say that makes the gig economy better for people seems kind of out of touch.
Okay. Diane, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. I think, you know, I did talk to, as part of writing the book, people who are in a wide range of jobs. And what I found was there are plenty of bad jobs to go around in the current economy. And by bad jobs, I mean jobs that are insecure, in which workers are poorly paid, they have no benefits, they have no control. So think about fast food workers, retail workers, people in jobs like that. What happens is, if in the gig economy, is that those workers actually have the opportunity to move from those bad jobs into better work, meaning that they are still in work that is insecure, that isn't well paid, that doesn't give them benefits, but now they have control, autonomy, and flexibility. So the example I like to use is, you know, there's hardly a line of people who are anxious to become taxi drivers, which is a job that meets all those criteria, but there are a lot of people that are willing to become Uber drivers. And even though it is insecure, not well paid, there's no benefits associated with it, they have control over where, when, how, and how much they work. And so the gig economy opens up opportunities for lower paid workers to access work in a way that meets their personal lifestyle and allows them to kind of fill in the gaps and earn money. So there are, it's not all the way there, clearly. This is still an issue in our economy, but it's a move in the right direction.
And overall, in our last minute here, what advice do you give your students? How do you brand and create a resume? And what do you tell your parents? I mean, what are some of the key strategies that you tell your students?
I mean, I address all of those in the book, and I have a lot of exercises that I have tested on my students to go through and actually come up with a gig economy plan for how to succeed. But I think the biggest step is to change the mindset from, you know, one where you're an employee, where you outsource your professional development, your financial security, your stability to a company, to an opportunity mindset where you really take control of that.
All right. Diane Mulcahy, author of The Gig Economy, The Complete Guide to Getting Better Work, Taking More Time Off, and Financing the Life You Want. She's an adjunct lecturer at Babson College, where she created and teaches the MBA class Entrepreneurship in the Gig Economy. Diane, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, a new memoir of love and loss in the early days of the AIDS epidemic. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.